The Meat for TCast is brought to you in part by Sone Lab, a recording studio in East Hampton, Massachusetts. Offering recording, mixing, and mastering of all styles of music, we even master podcasts. Email info@sonelab.com for more information. That's info@sonelab.com.
That's the record button. Have we started?
We have started.
So, this is the Meat for TCast. We might always start like that. Who knows? Hello, hello.
Hello, hello.
I'm Elizabeth McDuffie, and you're not.
I'm Mark Allen Miller, and this guy is not.
I'm Sebastian Miller.
Yeah, that's right. Sebastian is back with us again.
We have our special guest.
Another one of the Meat for TCast. This one is Season 3,
Episode 9. Number nine.
So, yes, welcome to Season 3, Episode 9 of the Meat for TCast, in which we have a couple special guests.
Some illustrious authors. Gerald Yell, who's published many, many, many times in Meat for Tea, and Richard Horton, who's also published many, 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 many times in Meat for Tea. Gerald Yell's history with Meat for Tea goes back a little bit further than Richard's, but Richard's first piece with Meat for Tea was in the Fond issue.
Yes, and wasn't the other one Pomegranate?
Gerald Yell is in the Pomegranate issue, which is the Fond issue. We were already Perfect Bound. Pomegranate was when we were still just bumped and stapled, looking like a zine, lean and mean.
Yeah, and probably under 50 pages. Not anymore. 140 plus on average these days, folks. Ooh. So, yes, we have a great conversation with the two of them.
They read us some things, too. They have a couple of books out. The newest one from Richard is...
It's Ballet for Murderers.
Ballet for Murderers, and it's got astonishing cover art by Beth Filson.
Oh, yeah, it's a great cover.
If you want to see more of Beth Filson's stuff, she's got one of her etchings and a short story in the Raw issue, which is available now.
That's right.
In stores at the public library and at meatfortea.com.
That's almost a segue into some other stuff like housekeeping. But
let's talk about Gerald first.
Exactly.
So Gerald's got a newish book from Finishing Line Press called...
No Place I Would Rather Be.
And there's no place I'd rather be than having a conversation with Gerald and Richard.
But yeah.
Before we dig into that, I suppose it's time for a little bit
of housekeeping.
A little housekeeping.
Basically, if you like what you're hearing and you want to help support what we do, first of all, tell your friends. That's probably the best way.
Tell your friends, tell your family, tell your grandma, tell your auntie.
Tell everybody.
I mean, go tell it on the mountain.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, you could do that, I suppose. You can rate and review on both Apple Podcasts and Spotify. You can write a review, leave a 5-star comment, and we will get boosted a bit in the ratings and maybe show up on other people's feeds just because of what they listen to.
So. Yeah, it helps other people find us, so it's a kind thing for you to do. Leave a review with writing, please, because if you just leave us stars, we can't read it on the podcast. We can't very well just be reading stars.
And we actually have an Apple Podcasts 5-star review from Ken 2082, and he says...
Thank you, Ken.
Yes, he says... A great show. That was wonderful. Nina Rossi's poems blew my mind. I am going to immediately seek out more of her work. So, hey, mission accomplished there, because not only does he like what we do, but he likes what some of the people we work with do. So,
shout out to Nina.
Yeah. But also, I think maybe...
Which podcast had Nina in it? Which Cirque was it? Was it Cirque du Noel? Was she one of the readers in Cirque du Noel?
I think so.
Is it the one before this one?
Up. So yeah, if you want to hear more from Nina Rossi, of course, you can go back a couple episodes to Season 3, Episode 7, to the Circuit des Fantômes Étrange. There's a... Oh, I hear the R now. Okay. Anyway, go to that one. Season 3, Episode 7.
French is an epiglottal R, just so you know.
I don't speak French, so you know. I think you knew that already. Well, also, other ways to support us, well...
meatfortea.com/donate.htm
or buy.htm. If you click the t-shirt icon, there's a whole bunch of different stuff you can get on our Teespring site. Sebastian, do you know what we have on our Teespring site?
Like mugs, t-shirts, anything you can stick a logo on.
Speaking of the logo.
Not everything, but tote bags and socks.
Yeah, and speaking of the logo, the Meetini logo, that's pretty special. That was given to Alex Wagman and me when we first started the magazine just about 16 years ago by our favorite bartender at Hugo's, Chris Wentz, who also happens to do a pretty mean illustration. And he gave it to us and told us to use it. And it hasn't been used except for in the very first issue of Meat for Tea until now.
Or if you're lucky to get some little limited edition mini magnets that we made a couple times. But aside from that, we haven't used it until now. And now it's on, hey, pint glasses, I think. No, maybe. It's definitely on tote bags and t-shirts. I think it didn't work so well on the pint glass. That's
what it's on a mug.
Yeah, I think the line drawing was too fine to do that. So I think that's why I made that choice. But if somebody really wants to have the Meetini on a pint glass or a mug.
It's not on a mug?
I don't know if it's on a mug. It might be on a mug.
I think it's on a mug.
Well, if you see a product and it doesn't have the Meetini on it and you want a Meetini on it, you can always email us like you always can at meatforteacast@gmail.com. Let us know what you want to see. Maybe we'll make it happen.
One more little announcement. We have a new submission manager, but that shouldn't affect your ability to submit. You should just be able to go to meatfortea.com/submit.htm and all systems will be go. We use Duosoma. You do need a Duotrope account. It's useful for writers and artists to have Duotrope accounts, and they're free.
Yeah.
So why wouldn't you? So, submit, submit, submit. The theme for this next issue is Russian Caravan. Have fun with it.
And we're open for submissions until when?
February 26th. Okay. So get her done, son.
Of course, if you're hearing this after February 26th, 2020, we're on it to a completely different issue of the magazine. So you can still go to meatfortea.com/submit.htm and see what we're looking for at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that takes care of housekeeping. I think we should
get on. Patter.
Let's get at her. Yeah, I think we should get on the conversation with Richard Wayne Horton and
Gerald Yell.
All right.
So we're thrilled to have Richard Horton and Gerald Yell joining us this evening on the Meat for Tea cast. Welcome, guys.
Thank you.
Hello.
Psyched to have you.
It's fun to be here. In my own study.
In your own study and in our dining room. Huh. Sort of as if you're our guest at dinner.
Yeah.
Which you shall be one time when the plague is passed. We will do that.
Oh, I can't wait for the plague to be passed, I tell you.
I know. It's an exciting thing to think about. I'm going to have a grand dinner party when it's all over and invite as many people as our dining room will sit.
I like that idea.
It was nice that you were able to have a circ, or a couple of them now, a couple of circs since.
Yeah. One in September and one in December.
Yeah.
Jury's out on March.
Mm-hmm.
Got my bands booked. If we can do it at Abandoned Building Brewery again, which is larger than Sewn Lab, so
yeah,
more room for air to circulate. We'll do it there if the numbers allow. And if the numbers mm-hmm. don't allow, you guys have both been in virtual circs in the past.
Yeah.
So we'll just do that again.
Do another one of those.
Do another one. So, Richard, what is stellar reading you gave at Writer's Night Out with Straw Dog Writers?
Yes, I was really surprised at the response.
Oh, well, I don't know that you should have been surprised. It was just amazing. And having Beth share the reading, it was so dynamic.
Yes, I think that really did something good for the text.
And that was Beth Filson?
That was Beth Filson.
Oh, yes, okay.
Yes.
I was still at work.
I know. I was hoping Mark could see it too. Has the video been archived? Do you know? Can people watch it after the fact?
You mean the Straw Dogs?
Yeah.
I don't think they record the video. They did post the chat log.
Oh, cool.
We'll have to poke around on their Facebook page and see what all might be there. If we find something, maybe we'll post it in the show notes.
Yeah, that's just such a stunning book. And Gerald, you've got a newish book too.
From the Finishing Line Press that came out in July. But I also have, I also got something taken up by Future Cycle Press, which was the place that did my first book.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm so happy to be able to work with them again because they do a good job. They have, I forget, Diane, the editor there, I guess she's just the person that runs the whole thing. She does a really good job of making sure that every single word is the way it should be and the way you want it. And it's not coming out until next February, so there's plenty of time to make sure everything is just right.
Oh.
So I'm looking forward to that. And whatever else happens in the meantime, too, will be just gravy.
Mm-hmm.
That's such good news. Well,
yeah.
Hint, hint, Meat for Tea is open for submissions.
Right.
For the next issue.
I'm making sure I get something good out there for that.
Yay.
Yay.
Yes. You guys,
so did I miss it? What are the names of these two books that we're talking about?
Richard Gerald's, Horton's book is Ballet for Murderers.
Oh, yes.
And Gerald, what is the one that got picked up by Future Cycle? What's that one
by
called?
By Future Cycle, it's going to be called Dreaming Alone and with Others.
Love it.
And the one that was done by Finishing Line Press was No Place I Would Rather Be.
Right. You gave me a copy of that. Thanks so much.
No, you're welcome. You're certainly welcome.
I love that.
This meat for tea phenomenon has just really been amazing because, you know, I don't know. All I see is that I'm not in it to be, and I don't have the psychological makeup to be out there like pushing my stuff on people, but just to be able to have editors and small presses just willing to read and publish your work. I mean, gives it the connection to the greater world than that I wouldn't have otherwise. So it's wonderful. And Meat for Tea, you've done it more than any other publications that I've gotten anything published in before. It's a lot. And I really appreciate it a lot.
Oh, that's cool.
Aww.
Sitting here with just a huge stack of things that have my work on them, and it's really great.
I know, it was so fun when I asked people to post pictures of themselves with their libraries.
Yeah.
Of Meat for Tea, seeing those huge shelves of all those issues of Meat for Tea.
Yeah.
In which you all had work. Well, it's more than just willing to read. I'm always thrilled.
Well,
to see work by both of you. And I've kind of come to regard you as sort of part of Meat for Tea's regular stable of writers.
That's amazing.
And how art galleries have their regular artists they get to exhibit. You've kind of, in my mind, taken on that sort of a stature vis-a-vis Meat for Tea.
Well, I'm so, so appreciative. And I think you're great for doing that.
Well,
Very
thank
nice.
You. So this book from Future Cycle, have I published any of the pieces that will appear in that book?
At least a half a dozen.
Half
a dozen.
I wonder if you might want to treat us to one or so of that half dozen sort of now-ish. It seems like not a bad segue.
Sure. The manuscript itself is on my computer, so I should be able to open it up. And I was just looking at it the other day because something else from that manuscript just got accepted in this Hole in the Head review. Have you heard of that one?
I have not. Should I check them out?
There's so many. On Facebook, I part of these submissions groups, of call for submissions kinds of things. And so there's like literally hundreds of places you can send your work.
Do they do a physical print journal?
You know what? I haven't even checked on that to see if it's just going to be online or not. And this Dreaming Alone and with Others is going to have from Meat for Tea. Oh, only two. I'm sorry. It's only got two poems. The one about Bjork, Between Provocation and Revenge, and the See Emily Alone.
Oh, nice.
So only those two. But I can read you one of those if you want.
I'd love it.
Would you?
I would.
All right. 2002, Between the Provocation and Revenge. A limpet bit me. My teeth hurt and I've got a sore throat. I have to put the kids to bed and call it a night, but a singer named Bjork is hopping around on local access 12. Her voice is haunting. Her dance has me watching. Her draped white sleeves basted to the bodice of her dress as if they're bat's wings. She wiggles her fingers and I wiggle back. She wants me to believe she can entertain in ways having little to do with sex, as if she's an angel. Why not, if it's all in my head? I notice the camera keeps leaving her to hover over the hands that work the controls. The moon spills across the stage. I know the show was recorded on what might have been a moonless night, but the camera won't stay on her, and there's a moon that will. Suddenly, she lets out a clear high note, and one by one, all the kitchens in Connecticut light up like it's supper time in winter. Now the neighbors want in. Every city and town and every school of fish from Paris to La Jolla, and the camera shifts. It's that.
Thanks so much.
I really like Bjork.
I like Bjork too.
She's pretty cool.
She's super cool. I like your poetry too. It's prose poetry, right?
Yeah, you know, I did go through the MFA program at UMass and really influenced by James Tate. I don't know if you knew him, but...
I did.
Me too, actually.
Worshipful company of Mother Fletcher's.
Yeah. But about halfway, maybe more than halfway or less than halfway through all his books, he started writing these more like narrative poems that had like story, you know, more like conversations with people, you know, I just sort of like hooked into that idea of just making it more accessible by just having it be more narrative and more prosaic in some ways, less similes and metaphors and less, you know, figurative language, but just basically tell stories or whatever. Things like that. He wrote a lot about relationships with his neighbors or his girlfriend or whatever, just little stories of interactions between people that I thought were really, really good and really readable. There was one, I don't know which book it was, probably The City of Lost Donkeys or whatever, White Donkey or whatever, that I never read a book of poetry that was like a page turner till I read that. And it was like, you know, you could just read them one right after the other really fast. And just, they were just something that was good. And, you know, it's too bad he had to die so young. But
Yeah, it is. No, his was a lovely presence in the halls. He was there while I was at UMass.
Were you in the fiction section or were you in the poetry or?
Neither. I was in the PhD program. PhD? Oh. Composition, rhetoric, writing and the teaching of writing. Reading lots of theory.
And was that in the 80s?
Oh, no. No, I didn't start work on my PhD until 98, fall of 98, 99.
Okay, so I was there before that. I was there from like 89 to 92 or 91. 89 to 91.
Oh, sure. That was the era that I worked at For the Record in Amherst.
Aha.
Do you ever go into that record store?
I'm pretty sure I did.
I imagine you probably saw young me with the spiky hair.
I probably did.
James Tate was one of our regulars in the store. That's how I knew him.
Was that the one that was sort of on the same side of the street as CVS?
Yes.
Yeah.
By that point, it was there, yes.
Yeah. Yep. I was there. And I remember running into him there one time. He was in there with Daryl Wire and I think he had just won one of those awards or something like that, where he had, so he felt like he had all the spending money and they were going out buying records.
I actually sort of remember that as well. So there you go. It's marvelous.
You were probably in there at the same time.
Yeah, I was 130 pounds, dripping wet, skinny kid with ripped jeans and spiky hair, and actually possibly almost no hair, shaved in almost all spots except for one. So I was the punk kid behind the counter.
Punk kids behind the counter were kind of frequent.
At that store.
Yeah, they weren't an unusual sight. Did you attend his reading at Wright Hall? I think that was in 99, winter of 99. I think that might have been one of his last public readings.
No, I think
it was a good one.
I think the last full reading I went to him was at Sunderland Library, believe it or not.
Oh, wow.
And I think, you know, he'd had his stroke, so his speech was a little slurry, but he, you know, he was a trooper. I think he was writing right up until the day he died. So according to what I heard, he had a poem in his typewriter the day he died.
Oh, wow.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So, Richard, are you a fan of James Tate as well?
I haven't read him yet.
Well, you've got that to look forward to.
Yes, I'm sure you'll enjoy it.
Yeah, I've noted it down, and I'm going to get into some of his things.
His later work I like better, because, I don't know, it was always, I guess, considered to be, you know, a surrealist, but his later work is surreal in a much more accessible way of just, you know, strange things happening in the real world to people, and rather than what you think of a surrealist poem with all kinds of symbolism. He sort of like got away from a lot of that.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one reason why I like to pair you guys both together in this podcast, is I think both of you lean towards the surreal, at least in your situations. In your writing, I think there's a shared aesthetic. How do you guys feel about that? Am I just dead wrong?
No, I'll let Richard talk a bit, but one of the things I like about Richard's writing is when he writes about children playing together or talking to adults and the interaction between the adults and the children, and I think that's a really, he has a really unique way of doing it that's funny and interesting and surreal in its own way, because it's almost like cartoon characters or something like that. But
yeah,
in a good way.
Gerald, what book was that?
One of your latest books that you have, like the kids talking to each other and then talking to the adults. Well, there was that one story, in your last book, where the one boy goes to the other boy's house for lunch play. But then even before, and there was one I was reading in Meat for Tea today about something about a funeral. Kids had to go to a funeral and they were
outside. Oh, yeah.
And then they had to, the mother was calling them in because they had to get dressed and get washed up. And the kids, come on, let's go to the faucet, you know. And it just struck me as, you know, good. And it's unique.
And the dream about the faucet.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
So which story is that in, Richard?
Well, it's in the most recent Meat for Tea, is it?
No.
I don't know. It's, you know, I don't think it's the most recent one. Richard, can you remember which one it was?
Yeah, I'm looking for it here. The funeral. Yeah, the set is called The Funeral. And I really pared down, you know, the language. So all you're getting is where they are and what they're saying. But it's more than that.
I think we should hear it.
Or a segment of it, depending on how long it is, but sure, yeah.
I think it's in my other book, which is in the other room.
Yeah, Richard, if you want to go grab that book.
Okay.
Okay. Well, then, in the meantime.
Well, in the meantime, what do you guys think about poet Russell Edson? Gerald, has he been an influence on you at all? Are you familiar with his work?
Yes.
I thought you might be.
Yeah, I remember my my father-in-law, who was a UMass professor, had a copy of good-sized copy of his one of his books, and I think I borrowed it, and I think I still have it. And I remember James Tate talking about him and saying he was really good. And I remember my father-in-law saying that they'd had an argument when I don't remember which prize it was, that my father-in-law was on the committee for, I don't know if it was the Bollingen Prize or something like that. And James Tate was on the committee too. And they were arguing over James Tate wanted Russell Edson to win it. And my father-in-law wanted somebody else to win it. And I don't know. I can't remember who won, if they compromised or something like that. But yeah, I'd like those really short prose poems, flash fiction-y type prose poems. And I guess it's kind of like what I really have been into so much the last few years. You know, writing a good poem it's satisfying, but it seems to take a lot longer than writing these prose poem, flash fiction kind of hybrid type things.
I take forever writing a prose piece.
Do you? Go straight up.
Always some little something that you can tweak and bring it out better.
Well, that's true. That's true.
Richard, I want you to talk about what bringing it out better is. Like, what is the it that's being brought out? I want to learn about this.
Well, what I want is to remove barriers between the reader and the images or what's being said. So I clean the piece, get the trash out, you know, get myself out until it can connect cleanly with connect with the reader cleanly with nothing in the way. And especially when it's small, I don't have any fragmentary or incomplete pieces. The small pieces are especially tight and on purpose.
So you're making the connection between the reader and the writing on the page as near immediate as possible. Am I understanding this right?
Yes, I'm talking to you. I'm talking to you, the reader.
But you, the writer, is out of it. It's the writing itself that's talking to the reader. Is that it?
The narrator.
Yep.
The narrator is talking.
Yep.
And the narrator, I mean, I'm writing the narrator.
Sure.
But the narrator is not me. But I have to be true to the narrator.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I get it.
Me too. And I love it.
I admire that. I'm
and I love these strange, quirky voices you find, these people you conjure up.
And you know, they have to be real. I mean, I make them up, but if they're not real, there's no use talking. It's got to be, fiction is really a lot more real than nonfiction.
I agree. Actually, back when I was teaching college classes, the further I got in my education, the more I taught, the harder it was for me to answer the question of what's the difference between fiction and nonfiction when students would ask. And I'd end up saying that fiction is where you'll find the most truth.
Yeah, because you can get at it and without the facts getting in the way.
I love it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And students would always give me a look like I'd just lost my head, of course. Well, you'll find the most truth in fiction.
But here's something that is kind of important. The piece can't just be a set of impressions. There's got to be a point. It has to deliver something, if not a message, some sharp experience engineered in the way it's told. Or some insight or bigger view. You're not just riding a train. You're in on a joke or a jolt of realization. The piece reaches deeper inside you than your eyes or ears. And I like to say my pieces don't carry freight, but they line something up for you. If they're odd, they're not merely odd. I want them to grab your subconscious, if there is such a thing.
Yeah, no, I absolutely get that. I feel like when I've written a successful poem, the process of composing that is kind of like writing a good joke.
Yeah.
Like you make that perceptual shift.
Bring it home.
Mm-hmm. It's got the punchline doesn't have to be funny, but there has to be something that causes that shift in perception. So, Richard, you've got a new and improved 2.0 version of your story that you were going to read us, one that appeared in Meat for Tea.
Yes, and how am I loud enough?
You sound great.
You sound perfect.
Well, guess where I found this? In Sticks and Bones.
Mm.
Oh, hey. Well, now, I need to go and reread everything that a contributor ever wrote. So that's in the first book that that's in the first book you published, which was with Meat for Tea Press.
This version is much, much better.
We won't tell that to the people that are happy owning their copies of Sticks and Bones. Or maybe we will tell them where to find this much better
when
version.
When you put out this new version of it, we'll,
it'll appear in the new issue of Meat for Tea.
Uh-huh.
Gotta go get the remix.
Right, Richard, you're gonna send it along.
What exactly are you saying?
This new and improved version could appear in this upcoming issue of Meat for Tea.
Even though it has appeared in the previous issue.
Sure.
I mean,
in the chapbook.
Yeah.
And in the chapbook.
Yeah, it's a new version.
But it's a new version, so it's different.
Okay.
And also, I think people might be interested. We've got a lot of nerdy readers, and I'm a nerdy reader, and I think people might like tracing that evolution. Because I think that's interesting.
Yeah.
It's sort of like finding a remastered version of your favorite record and hearing what they changed. And
okay. Want me to lay this on you?
Yeah.
Lay it on us.
The Funeral, Part 1. The kids put themselves in a hole. After their naps on floor quilts in the shadowed living room with the fan going, Mama told the kids they could go outside and play. But when they got there, Maggie said, "Someone isn't here." Robert hung his head. But then he and Maggie thought of a game. They would dig a hole in the yard, run around, yell, pretend to shoot each other. When they were good and dirty, Mama opened the screen door and called out, "Come in now, it's time." They got sad all over again. But after she went inside, they yelled and played some more, threw clods of dirt, made gun noises, fell down, then laughed and jumped back up. Mama came out again, brushing her hair. "Get in here, I'm going to whip your butts. Aren't you sorry about little Jimmy dying?" The kids minded her then. Robert said, "We got to put on funeral suits." Maggie said, "Come on, Robert, let's go wash our arms and legs at the faucet at the side of the house." They walked there, all slow. Maggie's dream about the faucet. "I've got to wash my arms and legs at the faucet at the side of the house. I will obey and do it." Now I'm at the side of the house. The boards are painted gray. Shadows of tree leaves flicker back and forth on the boards. The faucet has something it wants to say or give. The something is in its mouth, and the something is coming out. It looks like a worm. No, not a worm, an arm, a baby arm. The rest of the baby is trapped in the faucet. The hole is too small. The arm sways and reaches. "Mama, the hole is too small. It's too small. Ma." As Jimmy sat in the darkness, Robert thought of Jimmy when he was alive, and he sat under the pine tree one time next to his daddy's car. He was playing with the hammer, and suddenly he took and hit his daddy's car with it. He grinned up at Robert, happy at what he'd done. There was a crackling noise as chips of paint spit off the metal where the dent was. Jimmy's daddy ran out of the house and yelled, "Jim, give me that hammer, you little bird brain." Jimmy's face made its own darkness. Jimmy sat still in the darkness. They left in the funeral car, 1, 2, 3. They were all sitting in the long black funeral car. Mama got in. Now, who did I forget? 1, 2, 3. She counted the kids. They were trying to behave and sit straight. They were itchy in their funeral clothes. 1, 2. Robert, what's wrong with your face? Maggie said, Mommy is making his face do something. Robert thought, yes, I'll do something now. I'll make my face do something. Mama turned away quick. A strand of hair on the back of her head lifted like a spider leg. She looked back to count the kids. Her finger poked the air, 1, 2, 3. Who did I forget? I know someone isn't here. Mr. Madison from the funeral company crawled in behind the wheel. The fine wrinkles on his face made him look sour. His suit-sleeved arm threw forward and his hand dropped on the gear shift. Robert looked out the back window as the funeral car started out. Someone was back at the house, coming out, running. He said, we have to go back. Mama said, back? Go back? Keeping his eyes carefully on the road ahead, Mr. Madison murmured, well, if he couldn't be on time, he'll just have to catch another coach. After a minute, Robert looked again. He's still back there, and he's catching up. All right, if that's how it's going to be, we'll just go faster. He accelerated, and the car roared along, passing fields and clumps of trees, rocking a little in the wind. Staring straight ahead, Mama said, Robert, don't look back there at him anymore. Pretty soon, they started hearing the pounding of feet at the side of the car. Mr. Madison muttered, I don't know how someone that small can run so fast. I'm doing 55 already. If I go beyond that, I'll exceed the speed limit. Mama screamed, don't anyone look at him. And there you go.
Yay. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Sounds like they're getting chased by the ghost of the dead little boy or something like that.
Yeah.
Who's the person whose funeral they're going to.
But I never say who it is, you know.
No, you don't have to. It's
and maybe if it is the boy, maybe it's not the boy anymore.
Right, right. What's he become? But you don't need to know. It's just that's the way the characters interact is what does it for me.
Yeah, I think it's the talking. Everything has happened because of talking. It's being talked into happening.
Mm.
I want you guys to talk to each other about your writing. That's exactly what I wanted to happen. So thank you for that. That's exactly where I want this to go. Because you guys have known each other for how long now? A decade?
Well, I don't think it's been that long. What do you think, Richard? I think
around 13 or 14, 2013, 2014.
Okay. So going on a decade then, because it's 2022, so 2013 would put us at 9 years.
It might have been a little later than that. I didn't really know Gerald. I saw him around.
I think the first time I remember seeing you was in Springfield at one of Maria Louise's thing in the library.
Oh, yeah.
That Tommy was able to get the Florence Poetry people to have some, like, go as a group to the thing, one of these reading series that Maria Louise was putting up in the Springfield Library. It was really fun. I lived right around there for a while. I lived in a rent-controlled apartment building right on the, what do they call it, the quadrangle there where the museum's in the
library. Yeah, yeah.
But then when I, going there that, you know, for the reading, I took a walk around there and that building is gone. So it's all part of the museum complex now, I guess.
Is that the main library?
Well, it's on State Street. My apartment was on Elliott Street, but it's now, I'm not even sure there's an archway over it now, and it might still be a street, but it just goes into, I think, like a Toyota parking lot or something like that. It's hard to visualize.
Maria was so good to me and to all the poets that came.
Yeah, she's great. She was at that thing in Holyoke, that book fair in Holyoke. That was kind of interesting.
Yeah. And once again, she bought my book.
Well, that's great.
This is weird. I don't think I know Maria.
Maria Luisa Arroyo.
Oh, yes, I know her. Poet Laureate.
Yeah.
East Hampton Poet Laureate.
Springfield.
But I know her. She's done Unbuttoned, hasn't she?
That I don't know.
I don't know. She's done Straw Dogs, I think.
I need to do more Straw Dogs. Those Writer's Nights Out are amazing.
And we'll be back in just a moment. And welcome back.
So you guys met around 2013, 2014. So you guys both started sending stuff to Meet for Tea around the same time?
Yeah.
I've seen Gerald's things back pretty far in Meet for Tea.
Gerald, I think you go way back to the earliest days of Meet for Tea, too, even before we were in our current format.
My first publication there was Volume 6, Issue 3, September 2012.
Wow. So you've been, a full decade.
That's right. That's right.
I know. That's from when we were just bumped and stapled.
Yep. Yep.
And maybe like 40 pages an issue.
It's like the last issue that was like that, apparently. And it has a little CD inside of it. Four songs.
That's back when we still had CDs.
Mm-hmm. It's the pomegranate issue.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Really cool cover.
Yeah. That's wild. And Richard, you're a little bit after that.
Mm-hmm.
I think we were already Perfect Bound by the time you came on board. Is that true?
Yeah.
So would you guys say you're both absurdists of a sort? How does that strike you? How does it sit? What about you, Richard? Do you feel like you're an absurdist?
Well, I like to say things in a way that sort of pokes at them. I don't know if I am an absurdist as a style, like where you put two different things together and they clash, and so there's more noise. And I use it, though. I use it in image encounters.
Mm-hmm. Elaborate on that, please.
Yeah, as I say in one poem, two create both. Or, let's see, duality creates consciousness. But some people have bad connotations about duality. But I use it in an older sense as being in or out. Things are in a state of being nothing, really. Being there, but being nothing. Unless they come in contact, and then one defines the other, and the other defines the one, and they both start to exist.
Mm. Very quantum, very quantum observance, or Schrodinger's cat type. Like, is it there until it's observed?
Mm-hmm.
I like that stuff. I like to think about that stuff. I'm not as thoughtful as you are about it, though, but it's really cool.
And I guess absurdity for me is more like the existentialist, you know, the Sartrean kind of just that the world we find ourselves in, just, you know, we have to make sense of it. But the sense that we make of it is, you know, it's a good effort. But if you look at it without making too much sense of it, it's pretty absurd. It's pretty strange and almost comic, and it's tragic, kind of like strangeness. Life itself. I mean, just life itself.
True that.
I don't know, maybe just the way I look at it, but
no, truly it is. Truly it is. And I think you write a lot of pieces that speak directly to that, Gerald. That's what I like about them.
That's what I like to do.
I think you do it well. You take these seemingly ordinary circumstances and then things collapse upon themselves in surprising ways.
Yeah, and the normal is the most weird thing.
Yeah.
If you put it up against something which makes it strange, and why would I want to make it strange? Because maybe it wants to exist that way. Maybe it wants another kind of existence, another coming out to be what it is.
Yeah, the whole idea of being creative is just to make something that just wasn't there before, and if it's just another way of looking at something that's already there, then you know there you have something new just by looking at something that's already been looked at, but just looking at it in a different way, seeing it differently.
Make it be there even more.
Yeah, yeah. Elizabeth, you were talking about the difference between fiction and nonfiction
mm-hmm.
earlier.
It's so blurry. The more I know, the less clear it is.
The last year or so, I got caught up in reading this Norwegian writer, Knausgaard. And he's one of these people that all he basically does is write his autobiography, but he writes it.
Oh, yeah.
Writing a novel.
And he's famous.
To me, I find it utterly fascinating because, you know, he's revealing everything about himself, or maybe it's not, maybe it is, maybe it's not, maybe he's fictionalizing some things, but he's just bowls me over as a writer because he fills up so much space. I mean, I haven't looked at his volume 6 or part 6 yet, which is like 1,000 pages long.
Wow.
Parts 1, 3, 4, and 5. It's just really, really, really good. I eat it up.
I need to read him. I've listened to him talk. I've heard him interviewed.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, his writing his life as a novel while sticking true to his life as, I mean, here we're going to get into like truth and fiction and
yeah,
the fictions and autobiography, and we could get very complex and theoretical if you felt like going there, because I could take you. But his decision to do that had some, it was brave of him because it had some effects on his life. You know, I think his wife left him.
Yeah.
For starters.
I guess his father's dead at the beginning of it. So I guess the things he says about his father, he can get away with because I think his father must have died before. Well, no, it's hard to believe that. But volume 1 starts with his father being dead. And so, but then he goes back and tells his whole story of growing up and his childhood in Norway. And you know, I never knew anything about Norway, but now I feel like practically that I've been there because he just writes about it so well. And
I want to read those. See, now I've got to add something else to this stack of TBRs.
Yeah.
My stack of TBRs is so huge. Richard, are you familiar with this author?
Is that Knausgaard?
Absolutely correct.
Yeah, I looked at, but I think I may have seen his books mentioned a few years ago. So I'll try to get hold of one.
Yeah, I've been intrigued by him. It always makes me wonder how many writers are just waiting for their parents to die before they can bust out and say this stuff.
Well, yeah. Well, my mom's in a nursing home right now, and she...
Oh, I'm sorry, Gerald. That was an extremely insensitive thing of me to say.
Oh, it's okay. It's almost comic because you go see her, and every 5 minutes, it's like, so what's new? So what's new? And she doesn't remember the last time she saw you. She knows who you are, but she doesn't remember the last time she saw you. And she doesn't remember who she's seen in the last, you know. So she has no short-term memory, but she always seems to be in a pretty good mood. So a little confused at times, wondering how long she's going to have to stay there. But there's really no place else for her to go now.
Yeah, I remember that experience.
So my sister crazy. My sister really... I almost lost her mind trying to take care of my mom.
Oh, boy.
And then my dad was at the soldier's home, but he was lucky enough to die before COVID hit. because what happened at the soldiers' home during COVID, I guess, wasn't. But, you know, all the, they got a lot of bad press over that, but I'm not sure it was deserved because they seem like such a fantastic place for the people that were there that, you know, it's hard for me to believe that the people that ran it, the people at the top of the organization, they had to be doing something right in order for the place to be run so well, I thought. So, you know, you could blame the game all you want on people, but and yeah, I guess eventually they decided they weren't going to press charges or hold these people personally responsible for what happened.
I think that might be appropriate because
we didn't really predicted.
Yeah, we didn't know.
They didn't know what hit them working. Initially.
Yeah, none of us knew how this. We still, you know, we're still going back and forth on how this is all working, but we know a lot more than we did then. That's for sure.
We do. We did. Yeah.
Yeah.
I have a kind of fun idea. If you guys had to pick a piece each by the other that you want to hear the other read, what would it be?
Ooh, it's not probably, I don't know how Richard would feel, but it's something that he read in Holyoke, but I'm not sure he wants to read that one again.
What is it?
Well, the accordion one.
Oh yeah, the accordions. I've got that somewhere. Gerald, I have your new book in the other room. And
so great. So we have a couple pieces from each other that we might be hearing from?
Yeah, but I do want to hear about why you made the selection you did, why it grabbed you.
Well, could I tell you why I like the accordions piece that I asked Richard to read?
Would you please?
Mm-hmm. It has a high energy aspect to it and very poetic aspect to it because of the repetition, and it's also a kind of a joyous piece, which, you know, is not that easy to come by for, you know, for me anyway. But it's also, it has comedy, it has a lot of joy to it as well, and he read it really, really well in Holyoke last month.
I was sad to miss that reading.
Yeah, it'd be nice to have it here, though. That's cool.
All right. Well, Richard Horton, the well-endorsed, joyful, multidimensional piece that's got it all, the accordion. Could we hear it?
Okay. A sparrow finds meaning in poetry. A priest turns the page. Accordions march, but are not dictators. In the Poet Cafe, a table needed cleaning. A sparrow's twig legs hopped over fries, tasty lumber. Then the bird lit on the sandwich and savaged it. Get at the meat of the poem and drag it out. That's right. That's the payload right there. Across the street in the church, the priest struggled to turn a page and found himself rising with a terrible lightness to regions unknown. The balcony began floating away, but a saint stayed behind, snagged in a window of doubt. The choir made lovely sandwiches of sound while the sun ignited the church front. A raised hand released the worshipers, and they gathered in the door's shadow till it swung wide, and pigeons dived with murder on their mind. On the wind took a church leaflet on a journey high over the city. Pilgrims crossed a river of cars to the breakfast joint, which swam in a brown beverage of shadow. Inside, their voices cranked and settled at the construction site of their breakfast plates. Somewhere there was a high window where a watcher laughed but cried too as dirty little gods walked the street below. Colossal worlds veered drunkenly beneath an unfair traffic light, and a clock hand that had fallen off the tower was cutting off all escape. Near the watcher's bed, the next dream waited patiently for his return. Across town, accordions were on the march down Main Street, dancing as they played. One held a flag. But they were hungry, those accordions. That wasn't good. They entered the cafe where we sit now, watching them come in. They saw the merrymakers here and wished to join us. Welcome, accordion. Everyone looks up and smiles. Mom smiles. Dad smiles. Grandma smiles. Grandpa smiles. The children smile. The smiling cook. The smiling dishwasher. All the smiling customers. Even the lovers in the corner. Oh, you lovers, we saw you kissing just now as the accordions played. Do you know what time it is? It's time for a celebration. Up goes the confetti. Up go the balloons. Up go the petticoats. Oh, my accordions, bringing back the old country. Not leaving, are you? Come back to us again. They were at the door, but they've stopped. They're turning around. They're coming back in. One more time. Dance, 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 my fingers. On the keys of my accordion, can-can fingers, tango fingers, wildly dancing fingers. Play us a tune. Oh, play that melody again. They must have heard because they've stopped. They smiled at each other. The raised baton, they're playing it again. My favorite melody. I'm in tears. Give me your handkerchief. It's wet already. Give me another one. That fellow's not crying. Let's steal his handkerchief. Oh, what a prank. He needs a good slap with a wet handkerchief. 1,000 wet handkerchiefs. Slapping 1,000 serious faces. Slapping friends. Slapping total strangers. Slap, slap, slap. Everybody's slapping each other. What a funny night at the cafe.
That's marvelous.
I like it.
Yeah.
Thanks for choosing that piece, Gerald. I love that. Richard, the first issue of Meat for Tea you were published in is the Fond issue. And I am fond of that piece of writing.
Yeah. When you wish you could have written it yourself, then you know it's a good one.
I know that feeling when it comes to music.
So good. Uh-huh. Genius. So, Richard, what did you choose that you want Gerald to read?
Well, here's one about a mockingbird that goes through changes. Parts of it make me think of Walt Whitman's poem about the two birds, the north and the south, and the terrible tragedy of one bird that doesn't come back again. Maybe it died.
All right.
But this is called Black and White Dreams Being Symptoms of Unhappiness. Do you have that one, Gerald?
I do. Yeah, and that was published in a place that I think they wrote something about how much they liked it before they published it. All right, I haven't read it aloud before, but here it goes. Black and white dreams being symptoms of unhappiness. The mockingbird, having lost its partner, threw itself on the ground as if prostrate with grief, as if wanting to hurt itself more. It hopped the fence and flapped over on the other side. It folded its wings up straight jacket tight and commenced to peck, its beak barely touching the ground. What seemed an uncomfortably long stretch of unquiet desperation transformed the bird into a ballerina who took to her bed exhausted from the effort. When her boyfriend snuck under the covers to snuggle with her, all smug dimple smiles and dark curls, I hurled a rock at the foot of the bed. That got his attention. Instead of picking a fight, he tried to sell me a bag of reefer in a house at the end of a street in a suburb full of tunnels. I said what I wanted was a recipe for French toast. It was a lame excuse and a lie. I wanted to turn the bird into a bird, regardless of its suffering. I wanted to see what it would eat so I could tell my love about it later.
That's terrific.
Yeah, I like suburb full of tunnels. I've had dreams about that.
Suburbs full of tunnels. Yeah, I have a lot of dreams about urban landscapes.
That's very, very cool. Thanks, guys. That was awesome.
These things could go all night if we let them, but I think it's good if we don't. But this was like, thanks so much for sharing your brilliant works. Gerald, where was that piece published?
No Tokens. No Tokens out of New York, really.
Oh, cool.
Well, cool.
Shout out to No Tokens.
Small literary journal?
Yes.
And they do physical print copies?
Yes, it does have print copies.
Nice. Our numbers are dwindling, the number of journals that actually do that.
Yeah.
Even Tin House went only online.
Wow.
Yeah. I don't want that to happen to me.
Yeah.
So I think at this point, we should probably find out from each of you where people can find you
on
the social medias or... You know, good place to go looking for your published works, things like that. Promote yourselves with your internet presences.
It's the shameless self-promotion corner.
Well, I do have an Amazon page where pretty much all the books that I published are listed, and I hope available.
Are you on the shelves at any local bookstores, Gerald?
You know, I brought some things to the Amherst bookstore that used to be Wooten's a bunch of years ago, and they took some copies on consignment. And then, like a couple of years later, I went back and checked it, and they actually, you know, had sold a couple of copies.
Oh, it was good.
So, but I haven't really done that to other places. I have a next door neighbor that has a bookstore, and he said he would take some on consignment, and I just need to get down there and open to it.
Who's your neighbor with the bookstore?
Gabby Mushabek owns...
Oh, yeah. Booklink.
Yeah.
I know Gabby.
He's a great guy, but...
He's a sweetie.
He is. But it's a hard business, and it's like, I don't know. So,
yeah,
but
it is.
He said he'd do it. You just need to get down there.
Yeah, the follow through. I know that from...
He used to carry meat for tea, but he stopped carrying periodicals.
Yeah.
That's right.
Past experience, yes.
So, yes. One time when I couldn't make it to the Cirque, I ended up going there, and then I just ran across the street to the big one across the street from him?
Broadside,
yeah.
Yeah.
That place is impressive, too.
We love that place too.
But they're the first place that ever carried meat for tea.
Uh-huh.
And they still do very faithfully.
For 16.
I think the Amherst bookstore still does.
Oh, yes.
Amherst books. Sure. Yep, they do.
We are distributors aka ourselves by hand deliver them. So, yeah. Uh-huh. And what about social media, Gerald? Where can people find you and follow you?
I just have a I'm on Facebook, but I don't really post that often. Or
yeah, you have your personal page, but not like an author page.
Not on Facebook. So I guess it's all the Amazon one is. But
well, then the listeners need to go on Amazon and look you up and go buy some stuff. So that's
not that hard to do.
Yeah, no, not at all. What about you, Richard? Where can people connect up with you if they're looking for more from you?
At Richard Wayne Horton on Facebook.
Yay.
And my timeline is open to public, so anyone can come on and look what's there.
Nice.
Now, and I like to entertain people. I like to entertain anyone that wants to come on and see what I've put up. So I occasionally put a story that's been published, or I share an interesting article.
Yeah, I think I've seen you post a lot of interesting stuff over the time.
I like when you share what you've been listening to.
Yeah, what I've been listening to. Nobody likes my kind of music, but
I do.
I share it anyway.
You'd be surprised. You should see our record collection. It's so diverse.
Mm.
All sorts
music
of stuff.
Is very important to speaking. I mean, to speaking and writing. everything has a rhythm. Everything has timing.
Yes.
And drama.
I wish I could remember the name of this drummer on YouTube who drums along to scenes from movies and TV. If you do...
Yes, that's so cool.
If you do a search on YouTube for either... I think it's Willy Wonka with drums or Charlie and the Chocolate Factory with drums. You'll know it when you see it. It's about a minute and a half long, and it's the scene when they have to give up the everlasting gobstopper, and Willy Wonka is chewing him out, and he's playing drums to the dialogue, and it's absolutely amazing. And it shows the cadence of speech in a
rhythms
really beautiful way. Yeah, it's really cool.
Wow.
So there's something you can go do.
My two latest books, Artists in the Underworld and Ballet for Murderers, have their Amazon pages, which are easy to reach.
Yes.
And they're also available from Paul Richmond at Human Error Publishing.
Another lovely individual.
And are they at any local bookstores, Richard?
You know, it's just so much walking, and if you're lucky, they may sell two, and then you have to walk again to go to the store. And
I get it.
Yeah, understood. You know, consignment to individual stores one at a time when you're the person doing all the distribution is extremely, extremely labor intensive.
Which we do, but it's work. Just, yeah.
I mean, if I were dropping off a box of 50, it would be worth the walk, I would think.
Right. But yeah, because you're doing onesie twosie, and then you have to keep track of them.
Well, the bookstore is supposed to keep track.
The bookstores, and they usually do, but it's a good idea if you keep
track.
They
don't always.
Yes, things get muddled up, so it's a good idea if you keep track as well. And I've done it with my self-released CDs. I've done that with record stores, and I've always managed to mess it up and forget. And I've probably am owed money from a bunch of stores that I'll never collect because I can't remember. So there's that. But do you have either of you have any closing thoughts?
Well, give us one piece of music that you're really into right now that we should all go listen to. And I don't give a shit if it's contemporary.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, if it's not, that's even better.
I like that as a good idea for closing thoughts.
Verdi, Otello.
Nice.
Thank you, Richard.
Listening to the Xfinity's music channel for adult contemporary, and there's a song by the Killers that have nice. I never really listened to them or thought much about them, but they have a song called Quiet Town, which is just I think a lovely, lovely piece of work, like a 3-minute song. It's just I don't know.
Yeah, I love it when, even if it's not a band I'm familiar with, but I hear a song from an artist and really like it.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, I always like to have my ears open to whatever, regardless of who the artist is or who the performer is.
There's nothing like a 3-minute song. Although, fun fact about me, when I was 12 and singing mezzo-soprano in the Worcester Concert Choir.
Wow.
I sang Verdi's Requiem.
Wow.
And learned the Latin phonetically. There's a fun and weird fact.
Did you say you were in Worcester?
In the Worcester Concert Choir, yeah. As a little girl.
I lived there. Well, I went to school in Worcester in the early 70s, mid-70s.
I lived in West Boylston in the mid-70s.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, this was lovely. Thanks so much for sharing all your wonderful works. I look forward to seeing what comes into this next issue of Meat for Tea.
Well, thank you so much. This was very sweet of you to do.
It's much fun.
I love doing it. I wish we could do it with you guys at the dining room table.
Yeah.
IRL.
Get the layer of internet out from between us. It's it's nice, but we've all gotten used to this stuff, so I think we're all doing pretty well with it.
I think half the reason we do the podcast is so we can hang out with friends.
That's true.
It's been a lifesaver to have now. technology that can allow this to happen, you know? I mean,
it certainly has.
Definitely.
So people don't have to get each other sick as much as they would otherwise.
Yeah, people should stop doing that.
But we should probably say thank you and good night. So Richard, thank you.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
And Gerald, thank you so much.
See you, Richard. Thank you.
See you, Gerald.
All right. Good night, folks. So, thanks for sticking around. Wasn't that great?
That was awesome.
Yeah, it was a really good time. But you know what time it is.
Six-word stories.
It's time for six-word stories. And Sebastian and Elizabeth are going to take this one up, starting with...
Kim Keogh. Mask up, mask up, mask up.
And So It Came and Went by Basha Krasnov.
Constance Walter, he begged forgiveness. I said, no.
Next one by Carrie Moniz, I Waltz to My Burning Life.
By John Shearer, Icy Streets Spared My Life. Again.
Thanks, everyone, for your six-word stories.
That was my drive into work the other day, John.
We love them.
Seriously.
Look forward to more of those. This is going to be a semi-regular feature of the podcast.
Yeah. So thanks for sticking around to the end of Season 3, Episode 9. I think the 54th episode we've done.
54th.
Yeah. Creeping up on that magical 75. And then the super magical 100, which when we hit that point, we're going to have some sort of contest or something, I think.
We'll do a thing.
We'll have to do a thing.
We'll do a thing.
But for now, have a good week. See you actually in a couple weeks. Thanks for listening to the Meat for TeaCast.
Ciao.
Bye-bye.
The Meat for TeaCast is produced by Elizabeth McDuffie and Meat for Tea, The Valley Review. Mixed by Mark Allen Miller at Zone Lab, East Hampton, Massachusetts. Visit Meat for Tea at www.meatfortea.com. Please consider going to anchor.fm to make a contribution through our contribution page. You can reach us through meatforteacast@gmail.com, or you can leave a voice message at anchor.fm/meatforteacast. We welcome suggestions for contents for the Meat for Tea cast. If you've attended a Meat for Tea Cirque and want to hear from one of the bands or one of the spoken word contributors, please let us know. All portions are copyright Meat for Tea and their respective holders. Vote for Meat for Tea on your favorite podcast app. Follow us on Twitter at Elizabeef. Meat for Tea on Instagram. And on the Meat for Tea and Meat for Tea Cast Facebook pages. Meat for Tea is available everywhere you get your favorite podcasts.